This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We also tell people that they've been drinking wastewater all their life, they just haven't realized it. If you look at any major river system in the country, take the Mississippi as an example. Up in Minnesota, Minneapolis, they drop their wastewater into the Mississippi. It flows downstream. They take it out in St. Louis and they run it through conventional drinking water treatment and then they drink it.
What would you say to the idea of drinking a tall, cool glass of wastewater? On the face of it, it sounds, well, yucky. But it turns out you've probably been drinking it all along. There's good technology now for extracting impurities and making even the dirtiest water potable. And some water districts around the country are taking this technology to scale. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Mike Marcus, the general manager of the Orange County, California Water District. Orange County's practices may represent the high water mark for the reuse of H2O. We discuss the innovative technology the district uses to clean its wastewater, examine the costs compared to other alternatives like desalination, and talk about his team's efforts to overcome common misperceptions about turning wastewater into clean drinking water. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the general manager of the Orange County Water District, Mike Marcus. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good morning, Alex. Thank you very much.
So why don't you first tell us what sets apart Orange County's water district from, I don't know, one outside of Kansas City or one in Virginia Beach?
Well, the Orange County Water District manages a very large groundwater basin in Southern California, and it serves about 2.4 million people. And that population can pump out of the ground 75% of their total water demands as groundwater. So it's very important for us to keep refilling the basin so that we can sustainably pump out of the basin. Now the issue that we have here in Southern California is that we get a very limited amount of rainfall every year, about 18 inches of rainfall on average. So we live in a desert, and I think we need to educate our people of that fact. And so with that limited amount of rainfall, we have to find other sources of supply for our groundwater basin. And we've turned to recycling wastewater because that is, for us, the most reliable source of water that we can then put back into the ground, recharge that water, so that it can be pumped out and consumed by our population. Now, what we do though is we take wastewater from the Orange County Sanitation District. So all of the wastewater in Orange County goes to the Sanitation District. They then treat that water through a secondary process, a biological process, whereby it's safe to discharge into the ocean. But instead of discharging it into the ocean, we consider that not a waste, but a resource. So we capture that water before it goes to the ocean, and then we run it through an advanced purification process. And I think that's what sets us out. So we developed what we call the groundwater replenishment system. And what this treatment system does is it takes that wastewater that otherwise would be wasted to the ocean and runs it through an advanced treatment process consisting of microfiltration, reverse osmosis, and then UV light with hydrogen peroxide. By the time it goes through this advanced treatment process, it's of distilled quality water. We then take that water, put it back into the ground. It percolates into the ground, then is ultimately pumped out and consumed by the 2.4 million people in Orange County.
And one of the ways that you really stand apart is that final process. A lot of water districts create recycled water, but usually they're using it for golf courses and other industrial uses. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. That's what's called non-potable recycled water, and it's roughly the equivalent of the first step that we use, of microfiltered water. And you're right, what sets us apart is using the reverse osmosis and the UV light. What that does, through the reverse osmosis process, we're removing any viruses, dissolved minerals, or pharmaceuticals that are in the water. And the UV light gets any very low-weight molecular organics. So we are stripping all of that out of the water before it goes out into the basin. And what's noteworthy is the current project produces 100 million gallons of water per day and is the largest potable reuse project in the world. And we're looking at going into our final expansion, as a matter of fact, and just starting the design on that, which would expand the plant from 100 million gallons a day to 130 million gallons per day, which is our ultimate capacity.
And can you put that in perspective in terms of those 130 million gallons? What does a New York City use per day, for example?
Well, I can tell you that 130 million gallons will provide enough drinking water for a million people for 1 year.
Really? So in terms of cost, how much more does this cost than a standard treatment facility? And as you mentioned, Orange County is largely very arid. How long did it take for it to pay for itself, the project?
The cost of water out here in California is fairly high in that most of our potable water is imported. It's imported either from Northern California or from the Colorado River. So there's and we consider that imported water.
And right.
The major wholesaler of imported water is the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. And they provide that imported water. And the cost of our recycled water is about a half of what the cost of that imported water would be. What's really important about this project is it gives us water supply reliability in the area. And our costs have remained fairly constant while the cost of imported water is rising over time.
And are you aware of other similar projects that are going to be replicated around the country or more specifically in California?
There's many projects that are being considered, potable reuse projects. And in fact, the city of San Diego is developing a project right now that would be about a 20 million gallon per day project. And I think they're starting the design on that and will be completed 5 to 7 years from now. The city of LA, not quite as far as along, but are looking at a similar type project at a similar capacity. Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, I mentioned them a little earlier, being the major wholesaler of imported water, is actually looking at potentially building a potable reuse project ultimately that would be 160 million gallons per day. But that's still on the drawing board. That's well into the future. And then Northern California, Santa Clara Valley Water District has a 10 million gallon facility that's currently online, utilizing the same technology. And then if you look worldwide, the country of Singapore has actually implemented these types of projects. And they've been online for probably close to 15 years now. With our project, we came online, I think, as I mentioned, in January 2008. It's kind of as interesting aside, the Singaporeans actually came over here in the mid-90s when we were pilot testing the technology, and we shared our results with them. And I think that helped lead them into implementing the projects that they've built.
So, Mike, we were talking about the cost of reusable potable technology. Can you compare it to desalination efforts around the globe? It seems like it would probably be a much more affordable solution. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. I think that these types of projects, certainly we had the benefit of economies of scale. We had a very large groundwater basin. We had a place to put this highly purified water. Our costs are probably half of what desalinated water would cost currently.
For you. But in like Saudi Arabia, it might make more sense to go with desalination, is what you're saying? Where they don't maybe have as much groundwater.
Correct. Or as much wastewater to recycle.
I see.
Interestingly enough, in Saudi Arabia, it's kind of a cultural thing also. They are a little bit hesitant to utilize water reuse for religious reasons. For others, statewide, just speaking in California, and this certainly would extend to other parts of the country, because we are looking at Texas as being doing recycling, Florida as doing a lot of recycling. But for us in California, a new project would probably cost a little bit more than ours, but it would still be probably about a third less than desalinating seawater. Living a dream. My mind stopped aching. That's how it happened. Living life by the drop. That's how it happened. Living life by the drop. That's how it happened, living life by the drop.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the general manager of the Orange County Water District, Mike Marcus. So, Mike, you mentioned the hesitancy culturally in Saudi Arabia. I read an article in San Jose Mercury News that was chronicling the Santa Clara Valley Water District's recycled water project. And they said that some of the barriers has been what they quoted as what they termed the ick factor. And they mentioned, I thought it was kind of funny, they say, terms such as treated wastewater and toilet to tap don't exactly help that perception. And the headline of this article is "Toilet to Tap: Some in Drought-Prone California Say It's Time." So it's just almost too seductive for the headline writers. They want to be able to kind of get those clicks and get people reading, and it sounds kind of alarmist. But how much of a ick factor have you encountered in your county, in Orange County, with the recycled water project?
Good question, and we didn't get into the issue of public perception, but that was really one of the keys to success to our program, in that we started an outreach program very early in the process. I mean, before we even started designing the facilities. And what we did was we built up kind of coalitions. We first went to the people that were going to use the water and asked them for their support. We went to local elected officials at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, all getting letters of support from them. The environmental community, very supportive of the project, health and medical community. So we built this coalition, and that's what helped us kind of fend off any of those perception type issues. In fact, on our project, we had no active opposition to the project whatsoever. However, as you mentioned, the press seems to love the term toilet to tap. And the way we answer that question, Alex, or that comment or statement when it's used, is we tell them, really, that's a misnomer. I mean, what that implies is the water is going directly from the toilet into the drinking water system. And we say, it's not what actually happens. In fact, the wastewater flow out of a common household, out of the toilet, is about 10% of the flow, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have showers, you have sinks, you have washing machines, all of those flows out of a household go into the sanitary sewer. And then it travels from the sanitary sewer and it goes to the wastewater treatment plant. And they have a process. They settle the solids out, they biologically treat the water. We also tell people that they've been drinking wastewater all their life, they just haven't realized it. If you look at any major river system in the country, take the Mississippi as an example, up in Minnesota, Minneapolis, they drop their wastewater into the Mississippi, it flows downstream, they take it out in St. Louis and they run it through conventional drinking water treatment and then they drink it. And then they put their sewage back into the Mississippi and it flows downstream and it goes through this cycle such that by the time it reaches the Gulf of Mexico, it's been reused up to a dozen different times. So what we're doing goes far and above any type of treatment that is used anywhere in the United States. And our water is perfectly safe. We're coming up on our 10th anniversary in January and have been extremely successful. I mean, we test for over 400 contaminants. We have to test down to the part per trillion level on many of them. And we've never had a violation in our permit or had to shut the plant down because there was something wrong with the process. So we do have the technology and we do have the ability to remove all of the contaminants out of water. We've, I think, are an example that the process and the system can work.
And NASA has implemented a recycled water system so that its astronauts can safely drink recycled water. Has that been going on since the advent of the program? And I guess my question for you is also, did you use any of NASA's technology in developing the Orange County water system or vice versa?
You're absolutely right. NASA has developed systems for their astronauts from the very beginning. And although we do not use exactly the same systems, we use similar systems, and I would say that ours are probably even more robust than the ones that they use.
Really? Although this is radio, maybe you can kind of take us on a little walking tour, if you can, through the different steps of the technology. We kind of mentioned it quickly, but I'd like to dive a little more deeply into each step. First, is it the microfiltration? Is that the first step?
That is the first step.
So what's that look like?
Well, a microfilter is, the technical term is a hollow fiber. The more practical term is a straw. So if you can imagine a straw that had tiny holes in the side of it, that is what a microfilter would be. So a microfilter is a hollow fiber. It's made out of a plastic, polypropylene, and it has tiny holes in the size of it that are 1/300th the size of a human hair, or 0.2 microns. So imagine you had a straw with tiny holes in it. You pinched the bottom of the straw, submersed it in water, sucked on the straw. The water would come through those tiny holes from the outside, flow into the middle of the straw, and then out the top. Anything larger than the 0.2 microns would stay on the outside of the straw. So what the microfiltration does is it takes some of the larger contaminants, protozoa, suspended solids, and filters them out in the first step of the process.
Is the water just going through pipes and then these microfilters?
Our microfilters are actually a submerged system. So they, the microfilters sit in a basin. They're submerged. They're underwater. There's a pump down in the basin that's providing the suction. So that's pulling the water through the filters. So there again, that's the analogy of the straw. When you're sipping on the straw, providing that suction, that's what these pumps are doing. So as you suck on the straw, instead of coming from the bottom because you're pinching it, it's coming through the small holes in the side of the straw.
I see.
And then out the top. So as I mentioned, those larger particles, the protozoa suspended solids are taken or filtered out at that point. They stay on the outside of the straw. And the purer water goes through the straw and onto the second step.
Now let's get to that second step, this reverse osmosis process. We actually did a profile several years ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, with IBM, and they were talking about their reverse osmotic membrane breakthroughs. What does the reverse osmosis process look like at the Orange County Water District, Mike?
Well, the reverse osmosis, what you're doing is you're taking a semi-permeable sheet of membrane, and you're actually forcing under higher pressure the water molecules through that sheet of plastic. So because of the composition of the membrane, under pressure, the only things that are getting through are water molecules, And some low, what we call low weight molecular organics. So some real small organics are getting through that process also. But the larger compounds are not getting through. So here are any dissolved minerals, any viruses, any pharmaceuticals, all these big, large, complex organic materials are not making its way through the membrane. And then they more or less become what we call the reject or the brine or the concentrate stream. And that waste then goes back to the sanitation district and into their outfall. The purified water, though, makes its way through the membrane and out of the membrane and then on to the final step. So there again, we're taking the microfiltered water under high pressure. We're trying to force it through the membrane, and the only thing that's getting through that membrane are water molecules and low weight organics.
And then the next step is the ultraviolet light combining it with hydrogen peroxide. Does that affect the taste much? Explain how this works.
No, it really doesn't affect the taste. What happens is you've actually stripped out all the minerals through the reverse osmosis process. So it's from a taste perspective, it's rather tasteless. However, I mentioned that you do get some small organics that do slip through the RO. And what the UV light with hydrogen peroxide does is two things. There's two processes going on. The first process is what's called direct photolysis. And there's certain compounds, small organics. One is NDMA, N-nitrosodimethylamine. And we have to remove NDMA to below 10 parts per trillion as a part of our permit. So with NDMA, what happens is that is actually destroyed through direct photolysis. And direct photolysis is just, if you can imagine, different photons of light that actually break the chemical bonds of the NDMA and transform it into a harmless compound. So it's kind of destroying that that compound, kind of blowing it up, blowing up the chemical bonds and creating a compound that is harmless. So that's the one step. However, there are certain compounds, organics, that the direct photolysis has no impact on. There's one called 1,4-dioxane. And the 1,4-dioxane, the direct photolysis has no effect, like I said. So the second part of that treatment process, the hydrogen peroxide element, we do add peroxide upstream of the UV light. And that hydrogen peroxide through direct photolysis is converted to what's called a strong hydroxyl radical. So in simple chemistry terms, the H2O2, the peroxide, is transformed through direct photolysis to an OH dot, a hydroxyl radical. That hydroxyl radical will then chemically combine with the 1,4-dioxane and render it neutral. So two things going on in that final step, direct photolysis and what we call advanced oxidation, which is the addition of the peroxide. By the time it's gone through this three-step process, the microfiltration, the reverse osmosis, and the UV light with hydrogen peroxide, we've taken everything out of the water. As I mentioned, it's near distilled quality. And we mentioned, or you mentioned taste earlier, so minerals are what gives water its taste, but when you have low mineral water, when you put it into a pipeline that has cement mortar lining, it will actually leach the minerals out of that cement and eventually dissolve it. So we actually do add lime or minerals back into the water.
I thought the taste issue was maybe just solved by pumping it back into the ground, but no.
Well, yeah, we don't necessarily add it for taste. We add it to kind of stabilize the water. But you're right. Once you put it back into the groundwater basin, it also has some minerals there. But by the time the water is pumped out and by the consumer, it's actually fairly low in mineral content, lower than the native groundwater anyway.
So anybody who's drinking from a tap in Orange County is getting a combination of both the recycled and the natural groundwater. Is that correct?
Exactly right. Yeah, it's a blending of the two.
So why do you put it back into the ground? Is it just for taste, or could it go directly into the tap if you wanted to, Mike?
Well, right now, the regulations in California allow us to put it into the groundwater basin. That's called indirect potable reuse. So because we have a groundwater basin, we're able to, through the regulatory process, that enables us to produce this recycled water and then put it into the ground. However, it's kind of interesting when we give tours of the facility and we go through all the three-step process. At the end, there's a sample sink, and we give people a taste of the water. And they look at me and they say, well, you know, this tastes like water. And we say, well, it tastes like water because it is water. And then the next question they have is, well, why can't you put this highly treated water directly into the drinking water system? And we explain that that's called direct potable reuse. Right now, we don't have the regulations that would allow us to do that in the state of California. I might mention, however, that in the state of Texas, they do have a direct potable reuse project in Big Spring, Texas. I think it's about a 2 million gallon per day project. What they do is they use the exact same process we have, and then they put it into a raw water pipeline that then goes through a conventional water treatment plant and then is distributed to their customers. That's an example of direct potable reuse, and those types of regulations are being developed now in the state of California. We're hopeful in about 5 years that we'll be allowed to do that. We'll be allowed to use similar technology, maybe add some additional treatment, and then take that water, go directly into a raw water pipeline through a water treatment plant, and then into the distribution system. That's what direct potable reuse will look like, I think, in the state of California. The next question is, would we ever come out of the treatment plant and go directly into the distribution system? And that will probably take a lot longer. I think we'll have to prove the technology up. Ultimately, years down the line, we do that. Some people call that flange to flange, where you come directly out of the plant and go directly into the distribution system. I don't think we're there yet.
Well, what's the disadvantage of your current system? I don't quite understand what the advantage, I guess, of bypassing the groundwater mixing system would be.
Well, a lot of cities don't have groundwater basins.
I see. So it may not be as germane for Orange County, but in general, it's the technology is much more flexible if it doesn't have to go back to groundwater.
Right. And in fact, the project in San Diego, they have almost non-existent groundwater basins. They have a couple of very small basins. So they're looking at something which is more direct potable. You know, they'd use the same technology, maybe add a little bit to it. They're going to go into a surface reservoir and then through a water treatment plant and then into the distribution system. So that's more direct because there's no environmental buffer. Groundwater basin is considered an environmental buffer. So for those, at least in California, the way our regulatory structure is set up, if you have a groundwater basin, you can use the technology we're using. If you have a small reservoir or a raw water pipeline, that's considered more direct potable. We don't have those regs yet, but we will in about 5 years.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion, Mike, and I appreciate you taking the time. He's the general manager of the Orange County Water District, Mike Marcus. Mike, thank you for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Ernest Ranglin and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.